I'm Duke Gugino. I'm postdoc working at DESI. Yeah, and today I will talk about the dynamics and gravitational wave signal from very strong type of phase transitions in the early universe. And let me briefly explain. Let me briefly introduce myself in one slide. I got a PhD around 2000, in 2016, and I worked at Japan and Korea and Germany. And yeah, my research interests are like gravitational waves and new physics, and also Higgs dynamics in the early universe. For example, unitary violation issue in Higgs inflation, and also recently machine learning, neural network stuff, and also tunneling and gravity. But anyway, I will talk about first of all phase transitions today, based on these two papers. And this is the outline of the talk. It's in three sentences. In the coming decades, we have the opportunity to test first order phase transitions in the early universe with gravitational waves. However, in extremely very strong transitions, it's hard to predict the gravitational wave signal, even though they are both theoretically and observationally interesting. So I will introduce some of my researches addressing this problem. So let me start with very broad introduction about gravitational waves. When I write as GWs, it means gravitational waves in this talk, and they are defined as the transverse and traceless part of the metric perturbation, HIJ here, and I assume Friedmann Robertson background. And if you expand the Einstein equation at linear level, this HIJ obeys a wave equation sourced by the energy momentum tensor of the system. So, very roughly speaking, the Lambda oscillon of HIJ is sourced by a Newtonian constant G times the energy momentum tensor of the system TIJ. And as you may know, detections by LIGO and Virgo collaborations have been exciting us. So, let me enlarge this. Summary of the experimental observational status. This is observation one and two from 2015 to 17. So it's like 2 years, and they detected roughly 10 events from black hole mergers. And after shutdown, they restarted the observation three run. It's from in this plot, it's from April 2019 to May 2019. And this is 1 or 2 months, and they detected almost comparable number of events as the observation one and two. So this is very exciting situation. Now, in this talk, I will focus on cosmological gravitational waves. Gravitational waves from astrophysical, gravitational waves from black holes, I explained previously, is the gravitational wave signal at the present time slice. So in this slide, I put some schematic picture for the time evolution of the universe. So the time axis is like this. And if you go back in time, the typical energy scale is like electron volt at the CMB mass scattering. And if you further go back in time, then the energy scale becomes much, much higher. And in this talk, I will explain how to, well, I will explain or I will focus on gravitational waves as a probe of unknown events in the very early universe in this region. And one of the advantages of using gravitational waves can be understood if you compare or if you contrast with cosmic microwave background. As you may know, cosmic microwave background comes from the CMB vast scattering surface. It's around electron volt in energy. And if you want to probe the universe before this last scattering, the problem is that the photons are scattered by the charged particles. So we cannot expect extracting much information from CMB, I mean, information about the causal universe. But if we use Gaussian waves, since there they have only Planck suppressed interaction with other particles, they carry the original information around the time of their production. So that's one of the advantages of using Gaussian waves. Now, in this slide, I summarized present and future observations. In the horizontal axis, I plotted Gaussian wave, wave number or equivalently frequency in Hertz. And in vertical axis, I plotted omega GW, which is defined as Gaussian wave energy density, rho GW, decomposed into each logarithmic wave number, normalized by the total energy density of the universe, rho total. So this is a dimensionless quantity. And roughly speaking, we have three classes of observations. One is pulsar timing arrays, and the other is ground interferometers, and the last category is space interferometers. The first category is around 10 to minus 8 Hertz, and the second category, ground interferometers, are around 100 Hertz. And LIGO, Virgo, and Kagura Einstein telescope correspond to this frequency range. And our focus is space interferometers in this talk. It's around 1 hertz to 1 hertz. And what's interesting about this frequency range is that it has a one-to-one correspondence to the typical energy scale, or in other words, temperature of the universe at the time of Gaussian wave production. In this axis, I assumed that Gaussian waves are produced with horizons 0.1% of the horizon size. So it's somewhat smaller, shorter wavelengths Gaussian waves produced at the early universe. And if we assume this, the rough correspondence is like 10 to minus 4 Hertz is roughly GeV scale, and 1 Hertz is roughly TeV scale. So in this plot, you clearly see that LISA, for example, correspond to electroweak scale dynamics or some TeV scale dynamics. So this makes cosmological Gaussian waves interesting. Now, if we are lucky enough, we expect a signal like this from first order phase transitions. But unfortunately, within the standard model of particle physics, the electroweak phase transition is just a crossover, which means that the transition is not actually transition, but it's just smooth continuation from the symmetric phase to broken phase. However, first order phase transitions occur in many or some extensions of the standard model, like supersymmetric theories or extra dimensions or simple addition of singlets makes the transition first order. And also first order phase transitions provide a possible explanation for the baryon asymmetry of the universe as known from 80s. And on top of that, in the coming decades, we have chances to observe Gaussian wave signals from this process with interferometers like LISA, DESIGO, or Taiji Tenji in China. So let's focus on this possibility. Let's take it, let's consider this seriously. Okay, this is very broad introduction. And in the next 10 or 15 minutes, I will give a brief review about first order phase transitions and Gaussian wave production in the early universe. This is a rough sketch of the transition and Gaussian wave production. In one sentence, it's like bubbles nucleate, expand, and collide and disappear, involving fluid dynamics. Our assumption in field space is that we have at least one scalar field whose effective potential has at least two minima, two local minima, and one is false vacuum and the other is true vacuum. And when the temperature of the universe is high, the scalar field is trapped at the false vacuum. And as the universe cools down, the scalar field finds its way, the way to the true vacuum. So this guy tunnels to the true vacuum at some temperature. And very roughly speaking, the difference in the height of the potential, roughly speaking, is released in the universe. This is what happens in field space. And if we see this process in position space, first we have false vacuum universe, and as the universe cools down, very tiny regions of true vacuum nucleate here and there. And because the true vacuum is favored energetically compared to false vacuum, these bubbles expand, and collide. And the transition completes. And during this process, the aggression waves Hij is sourced according to this wave equation. And Tij comes from the bubble and fluid dynamics. So in position space, what happens is bubble formation and aggression wave production. This is very rough sketch, but in order to prepare for future observations, we have to take a closer look at this process. So that's what I will explain in the next slide. So let me talk about bubble dynamics before bubble collision. In single phrase, pressure versus friction determines the behavior of bubbles. This is a schematic plot for expanding bubble. And when one bubble nucleates, it has it typically has a particle physics scale, but just after nucleation, they expand to cosmological scale. So this is cosmological scale, very long distance. And yeah, pressure versus friction. So there are two contributions to the world. One is pressure, and pressure exists because the energy release pushes the wall outwards like this, because we have this energy difference in the between the true and false vacuum. And traditionally, this is parameterized by dimensionless parameter alpha, defined as rho vacuum normalized by the plasma energy density. And here, plasma particles exist everywhere in the universe, even before transition or after transition. The second contribution to the wall is friction, because the scalar field is typically coupled to plasma particles. So when they expand, the plasma particles push back the wall. So that's called friction. And let's parameterize the friction by symbolically coupling eta between the scalar and plasma. And in the next slide, I will show you some animations to see how bubbles behave for different alpha, different energy release. By the way, if you enlarge the region around the wall, what you see is the plasma particles impinging from outside. And typically, the plasma particles are massless outside. And when they enter the bubble, they acquire mass. And this transition from massless to massive gives friction to the wall. Now, let me show you some animations. This is classification of bubble expansion modes. I put the axis here. This is alpha axis. Alpha is vacuum energy density normalized by plasma energy density. And let's start from very small alpha. It's called a deflagration. And in deflagration, the bubble wall, a bubble expands like this. And the wall is located at this red line. And in this plot, the wall position is here and here. And these two plots are temperature profile and fluid outward velocity profile. So as you see from these two plots, energy injection occurs at this position. And as a result, the plasma particles outside the wall is heated up here. And also fluid outward velocity arises outside the wall. So it's like a bubble wall pushing the plasma outwards. And the bubble expands like this. And next, if you slightly increase the value of alpha, what happens is this kind of dynamics. And I hope you see the difference from the previous animation. Now the wall position is here and fluid behind the wall is now heated up, and also fluid outer velocity arises behind the wall. So it's like the wall dragging the plasma particle behind it. And expand like this.
I have a question. So this transition between the two regimes, can it be formulated in terms of relation between the sound speed of the fluid and the velocity of the wall or something?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's the answer actually. Deflagration is the wall velocity less than the speed of sound. Actually, this fluid front is speed of sound at the perturbative regime. I mean, let's forget about it. So this front is sound speed, and in detonation, the shell, the region, the boundary inside is the sound speed. Yeah, so sound speed characterizes the transition from deflagration to detonation. Does it answer to your question?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, now let's increase alpha to more than order one. It's called a strong detonation. And now the bubble behavior is a bit different. Now the wall expands with almost speed of light, like this 1.0. And one important difference from region two is that the energy is sharply localized around the wall, like this. Temperature is localized, and the fluid outward velocity is also localized. And here, what I plotted is not the velocity itself, but this is relativistic gamma factor of the fluid.
Can I ask something? So in your picture, you were showing that the temperature the temperature behind the shock is less than the temperature outside the shock.
You compare here and here. Right?
Yeah, yeah. So why is that?
For example, actually in this case also the temperature inside is smaller.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the question is, what is the question?
Well, so why is that?
For example, imagine snowplow. I don't know how to call it. I don't know the English word for that. Is it correct? Snowplow.
Snowplow. Yes.
Snowplow. Yeah. So if you perfectly snowplow, then there is no snow inside. So it's all the snow particles are swiped outside. So that's why the temperature is lower than outside. Or in some sense, this is kind of adiabatic expansion. So all the plasma particles are suddenly dragged outwards. So what's remaining inside is dilute plasma.
Well, yeah, so the density, can change, I agree, across the shock. But this is plotting the temperature, I thought, not the density.
But for example, if you are in, the simplest, for example, perfect fluid, relativistic equation of state, then the density is temperature to the fourth power. So, Could you tell me more precisely?
Yeah, so if you press the gas adiabatically, the temperature should increase.
If you press, right.
Yeah, then depress, the temperature should decrease. Is this correct? So that's why the temperature inside the wall is lower than the outside.
Right, exactly.
Okay, I see.
The mass of the particle inside the wall is massive. Is this correct?
That's correct. But here, assumption is perfect fluid both for inside and outside, because not all the particles get mass from the transition. Or for example, in electric transition, the quark gets only tiny mass, so that can be negligible, maybe. So the dominant contribution is massless particles. That's what I should say here.
Okay. I see. Okay, that's the difference between like normal astrophysical shocks. I see. Okay.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Astrophysical shocks. That's important. Yeah.
I can ask you, are you assuming that the world plasma is interacting with the scalar field?
Sorry?
Considering a situation like the electric phase transition, say, supposing it is a first order where all the plasma, standard model plasma, is interacting with the Higgs?
Some of the plasma are interacting with scalar field. If there's no interaction, there's no effect to our plasma. So it's...
Not directly.
Most of that in the context of dark transition, but my assumption is at least some particles are coupled with the scalar field.
And there is no particular feedback from the rest of the plasma and the part of the plasma that is coupled to the field.
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
I mean, let's suppose that you have the scalar field, the part of the sector which is coupled to it, and the rest of the plasma that is only coupled to this sector, but not really matched to the scalar field.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then two sectors can mix with their own interaction.
Okay, thanks.
Now I finished explanation for region three, and for one and two and three, the pressure and friction balance with each other. So as a result, the wall approaches terminal velocity, but if you further increase alpha, a funny thing happens like this. Walls start to run away. It means that the wall expand without caring about the plasma. In other words, plasma particles cannot stop the acceleration of the walls. So as a result, the bubble wall continues to accelerate until they collide with others. So these are four categories. But here, I have to mention that transition from 3 to 4. Before 2017, the boundary value, the threshold value, was considered as order 1. But suddenly, this Bodegren and Moore wrote one important paper in 2017. And as a result, now people think that the transition is roughly 10 to 10 or larger. And this 10 to 10 is not a random number, but it comes from the hierarchy between Planck scale and transition scale. So let's forget about 4 in this talk. So I will focus on 1, 2, 3. Now, let me recap because one of my collaborators was invited to interview at UNS data, if I understand correctly. So let me recap what happened in region 1 and 2. Okay, so far, just bubble dynamics before collision has been discussed, but Gaussian wave signals come from bubble dynamics after collision. So we have to consider multiple bubbles. And for relatively weak transitions, for 1 and 2, the dynamics is kind of known, like this. So first, fluid velocity field overlaps linearly here and there, and this kind of overlap effect works as a very long-lasting source of Gaussian waves, as pointed out in these papers. And the essence of maybe the essence of the yesterday's talk is that we proposed a new efficient scheme to calculate the Gaussian wave spectrum in this type of transitions. And let me very briefly comment this overlap effect. So why overlapping effect is important. And we know this kind of sound shadow overlapping from our daily conversations. So suppose that I'm here and you're here, and I say hello and you say hello at the same time, we can hear the other person at the same time. So we know that sound shells propagate and pass through with each other. And imagine that we have many people in, let's say, classroom, and people say something at the same time, then these sound shells overlap at each person's position. And the shell overlapping creates a new velocity field if we assume linear overlap of the velocity field. And that's what was going on in the previous animation. Let me explain this light snapshot. This is one snapshot from the previous simulation. And let's say five velocity field overlaps from five bubbles. And the typical length scale is the shell thickness, L shell. And which is, this is actually constant during propagation because this is roughly, this roughly corresponds to the frequency of your, let's say, your voice. And this typical L shell overlaps at this point. So this creates a new velocity field of typical wavelengths L shell. And as a result, typical Gaussian wave production occurs at wavelengths L shell inverse. That's what was going on in the previous animation. Now, now our interest, let's focus on our main interest in this talk, region three. In this kind of very extremely strong transition, which I call ultra super cold phase transition, the bubble dynamics after collision is much less known than region one and two, because first, the fluid is very highly relativistic, and second, there's very strong shock waves even after bubble collision. And third, there's in hierarchy in scales. That is, compared to the bubble size, the energy localization is very, very thin. So this makes a huge hierarchy if you want to simulate the system. So these three elements, factors, make numerical simulations difficult, even though they are at least observationally interesting, because if the energy release is large, we expect large Gaussian wave signal.
Can I ask a question? What type of potentials could generate this extremely strong, what you call ultra cold phase transitions?
Sorry, I couldn't hear the first part.
What type of potentials?
That's a good question. Okay, this kind of very strong transition occurs typically in nearly conformal type models.
And what does that mean?
Sorry?
What does that mean? I mean, think about, can you explain in terms of, because you're talking about the Higgs. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean for the Higgs?
One example is, okay, so I should mention that this kind of transition does not occur in typical transitions. And the condition for this happen is, let's think about, let's say, Coleman-Weinberg type potential without any mass term. Let's think about that kind of situation. So in that sense, let's generalize the transition to larger class than electric transition. Let's think about general transitions. And if that your potential is only Coleman-Weinberg type potential, it means that your potential, especially your potential around the origin, is nearly quartic. If you don't have mass term, any mass term, this is assumption. Then the thermal drop, suppose that we consider effective finite temperature effective potential, then the thermal drop at the origin is quadratic even after the universe cools down to very low temperature.
Yeah, so why isn't this potential tuned? Because you're assuming you have large couplings to the plasma.
Yeah,
but that, assuming it's conformal. So this is a tuned situation that looks like.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. It's if you use Coleman-Weinberg type potential, it's tuning. And some people say this is principle. There's hierarchy problem in the standard model of particle physics. So what people say is this kind of no scaleness is principle. That's what people say.
I mean, what does it mean to be a principle? We know it's violated.
So if you consider effective theories below some energy, and suppose that your input at the boundary condition is vanishing mass, then the running of mass appears multiplicatively. So that's what people say.
Okay.
I understand your point.
Okay.
This is not generic. This is very.
This is what I would like. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Please carry on.
But just to be like more concrete, like how strong do you need your phase transition to be?
Okay. So
The V over T or something is, must be greater than one. Is this the, this alpha is the same as V over TC or something, right?
Okay, so let me give you one example. So suppose that electroweak phase transition occurs at QCD still. Some people consider electroweak transition triggered by some QCD dynamics. In that case, the vacuum energy density released is roughly electroweak to the fourth power, and the plasma energy density is QCD to the fourth power. So roughly alpha is 10 to 12. If that really happens.
Right, so that's V over TC of like 10 to the whatever, 10 to the 5?
Yeah, 10 to 3, I think, because electroweak over QCD still. So 100 GV divided by 100.
Oh yeah, 10 to the 3, sorry. Yeah, okay, yeah. 10 to the 3. Yeah, that's really large. Okay, okay.
Yeah, that's extreme situation.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
honestly, I'm not that sure that it's, well, I shouldn't comment on that. People say that's principle. But anyway, we have observational chance to test this kind of scenario. So we keep open-minded and let's think about dynamics after that kind of transition. Now, the central question is the time scale for this energetic shell to break up after collision. Because we know that for region one and two, we have large Gaussian wave signal because of the shell overlapping from every direction. But if the collided shells remain to be thin even after, even long after collision, we cannot expect that effect. So, and actually this difference can change the Gaussian waves produced at typical shell scale by orders of, well, I shouldn't say this. This difference change the produced Gaussian waves by orders of magnitude. If you know this kind of business, the difference in the order of magnitude is beta over h, some parameter called beta over h, which takes roughly 1,000 or 10,000 in some cases. So the difference is huge. So we have to fix this or which of these two occurs. That's main part, the main motivation of my work. Now I finished a brief overview about the first law of phase transition and Gaussian wave production. So let me introduce one of my papers in 2019, bubble dynamics in this kind of extremely strong transitions. So let me first give you the main idea in the next two slides. So let's first divide the problem into smaller pieces. This is a schematic plot just after transition. And as I explained previously, very energetic shells are here and here and here. And after collision, the relativistic fluid shells have two effects. One is propagation inside other bubbles. And the second is collision between different shells. And in this paper, we studied only the first effect because this is simply because the propagation alone is already non-trivial because of the nonlinearity in fluid equation. So we just focused on the propagation effect and how propagation breaks up the nonlinearity in propagation breaks up the shell to thicker one. And we leave the collision as future work. So let's focus on the first. And the main idea is as follows. We constructed some effective description of fluid propagation with a few relevant variables, which is valid in high relativistic limit. So let's take alpha, the strength of the transition in the horizontal axis. And what we really want to know is very strong transition limit. But in this region, numerical simulation is difficult. On the other hand, for small alpha, numerical simulation is possible. And we have some overlapping region between the two. And our idea is we can construct some effective description of fluid propagation. That is, originally, the fluid profile has, of course, arguments T and X, but we try. We map this system onto some system with finite number of variables, which depends only on T. This is what we try from now. And if we can do this, we can check the validity of this kind of effective description against numerical simulation using this mildly relativistic region. So in the next slide, I first show the result of numerical simulation in this region, in this center region, to show, to get what's going on in the system. Okay, this is the result of numerical simulation. And this slide needs some explanation. We have two panels. The left panel is fluid energy density, and the right panel is fluid relativistic gamma factor squared. And assumption is, yeah, the simplest one. Energy momentum tensor has perfect fluid form, and also it has relativistic equation of state. That's the assumption. And because we want to study the propagation inside the other bubble, our initial condition, this blue line, is the fluid profile just after bubble collision. And please note that the vertical axis is logarithmic scale. So even though the shell thickness may look thick in this plot, actually the energy density is dominated around the peak. And this blue line is the initial condition. And I set the fluid, I start to evolve the system from this blue line. And as a result, this blue line propagates outwards. It's shown in the in this schematic plot. And yeah, so far I mentioned shocks without any definition, but it's defined. Here I can define. So shocks are defined as discontinuities in the fluid profile. This is a bit non-trivial because what we have is only fluid. So it's just del mu T mu equals zero with T mu this form. So it's a bit non-trivial. It may be a bit non-trivial to have this kind of discontinuity, but this kind of dynamics, discontinuity dynamics is already known in laboratory experiments. And now, what would be the relevant variables for effective description? From the viewpoint of Gravitational wave production, we are interested only in the peak quantity, because peak.
Can I interrupt you with a question here? Sorry.
Sure.
Just make sure I understand. I understand that you start off with the initial profile, the blue one, mm-hmm. and then the successive vertical lines you're drawing there. Is the idea that you have some sort of a condition at the shock front which is transferring energy into the fluid, and you're moving that position, or is it that you just take this initial position, this initial spike, and then you just evolve it as a fluid after that and no longer imagine there being transfer of energy from the shock?
Okay, that I think that's very, very good question. So I have a slide for that. The line, the gray line one, shows two profiles just before collision. And maybe what you mean is, so what the effect what is the effect at the time of first contact between these two? Is it true?
When you evolve things forward, I'm not sure what you're doing with the interaction between your fluid and the shock. And so I'm not sure if you're specifying some sort of a boundary condition there or how you handle that. I guess that's the question.
You said shock. You said fluid and shock, but fluid and shock are not something that can be compared on the same footing. I mean, discontinuity in the fluid profile is called shock, first of all. And
so I guess what I should have said is maybe the scalar field that's defining where your wall is as opposed to the plasma. And so I understand that you're evolving the plasma equations here. And I guess what I don't I'm not sure I understand yet is somehow that strong peak is coming from the energy being transferred from the scalar field, And are, how do you follow the scalar field plasma interaction as you evolve these things?
Okay. So I have two things to explain. So in this blue line, and this is just before bubble version. So actually the scalar wall is along this vertical line.
Yeah.
Okay. And what I explained in this slide is that the wall typically has particle scale gradient. On the other hand, the whole bubble has cosmological scale. So what people do in this kind of simulation or in this kind of business is translate the particle physics information into the information on energy injection along this infinitely thin boundary. Does it make sense?
So you're going to parameterize it by some sort of a not friction, but something which is dumping energy as opposed to removing energy.
Yeah. So we don't give friction explicitly. This vacuum energy density is translated to the amount of energy injection along this gray line. And if we fix the boundary condition, what we should do is just solve fluid equation starting from this gray line to inside or to outside. And that's just fluid equation with some specific boundary condition coming from energy injection from scalar field.
Right, and I understand that in that when you do that, you're allowing the position of the wall to change. So you're kind of tracking the motion of the wall position you're following the energetics of the motion of the wall's position as it transfers energy from to and from the fluid of the plasma, right? So does that mean that in the slide that you were showing us, that the evolution that you're giving us it's jointly evolving the fluid and the position of the wall,
mm-hmm.
keeping track of the transfer of information between them or the energy between them, through this, whatever's parameterizing this exchange mechanism.
Exactly.
Okay. So what you're not doing is just taking an initial condition for the fluid and evolving that forward and having that profile survive. The reason that the spike is there is that you really have the wall moving along and it's continuously providing energy to the fluid.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank
you. Enlarge. It's not exactly the step function, but it has this kind of scale.
Sure. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, that's one thing I should explain in this slide. And another thing is that at this blue line, I remove the information of the wall because this is collision time. So the scalar field disappears. The scalar configuration disappears at this position because implicitly there's another bubble coming from outside. So the time evolution from now is fluid evolution without any scalar field from this second line to this red line.
I see. I get it. Right. So I understand. Thank you.
Now let me explain how I can translate this system into finite number of variables. It's already 5:50. I'm sorry. I have to hurry. So I selected five variables in three categories. One is shock velocity, this discontinuity velocity. And the second class is the value, peak values, rho peak and gamma square peak. This is constructed from the fluid velocity at the peak. And the final category is derivatives at the peak. And I have to apologize for my confusing notation. Rho prime peak is x derivative or r derivative of rho profile just the at the position of the peak. And gamma square peak prime is derivative of gamma square with respect to r at the peak position. We have five quantities. And actually four equations are easily found. And these equations are strict equations. One class, the first class is Runge-Yugoniov conditions. This gives two constraints among these five quantities. And the second is time evolution equation because originally we have del mu t mu, so we have some time evolution equations. And this gives two equations involving time derivatives. And for completeness, I show you the four equations. The first class, Runge-Yugoniov, has this kind of form. These are constraints between some peak quantities, and Vs is what I wrote as V shock in the previous slide. And we have another condition like this. And the time evolution equations are like this. I don't explain the detail, of course, but this here's time derivative expressed by quantities without time derivative. So we have four equations, but we have five quantities originally. And yeah, so we have less equations than the number of the quantities. And of course, this is natural because the original system has infinite number of degrees of freedom, which means that we have infinite number of spatial grids, X. So if we could express the evolutionary system with these four equations, then it means that we have, well, in simple phrase, there's no free lunch. So we cannot translate the system to these kind of discrete quantities in strict sense. So the last equation to close the system should be approximate at best. And this last equation will be an equation characterizing our system. And I will explain this in the next slide. The last equation I imposed is the energy domination by the peak. What distinguishes this system from any possible system is the fact that the energy is dominated by the peak. So I impose this condition explicitly. And that's the final equation. This is a bit non-trivial. And here arises some ambiguity, because any relation like the peak energy integrated over the thickness of the profile equals constant, because this dominates the energy. This kind of relation will work whatever the detail is. And in our study, we approximated the energy density and gamma factor squared to be exponential in our direction. This is one choice. Then we can integrate this exponential profile using our five variables, which I mentioned previously. It's like T00 component, rho gamma squared, assumed to be exponential form, integrated over the profile. And this is peak value divided by typical thickness. So this is, yeah, this is natural. And the final equation is this equals to constant. That's the final equation we imposed. And the resulting system, now the system is five differential equation only in time for five quantities. And the resulting system actually can be analytically solved. And the result is like this. This is 1/γ shock squared as a function of time. And it has this kind of form with delta slightly less than one. And okay, I will put aside all the details. And the final implications from this study is that the fluid profile remains to be very thin until late times. And this is the main plot for that. The vertical axis is our alpha, and the horizontal axis is the gamma factor of the wall, which I didn't explain, but the final result is independent on this direction, so let's neglect it. And this color shows the shell lifetime, that is the time scale for the shell to be thick, divided by the typical bubble size at the collision time. So for example, for alpha 10 to 6, the necessary time scale for this thin shell to get wide, get thick, is roughly 10 to 3 of the typical bubble size. So yeah, the fluid profile remains to be thin until late times. That's the implication from this study. And please note that this is not yet conclusive, since the shell collision is not yet included. So this study is still ongoing. Okay, now I finished three. And yeah, let me wrap up. I will talk about Gaussian wave signal in this kind of transitions, and I will explain possible IR enhancement. So yeah, let's talk about Gaussian waves. Traditionally, Gaussian wave signal from thin bubble, we assume thin bubbles, because in the previous study, we found that the bubbles are thin. The Gaussian wave signal from this kind of thin bubbles has been numerically simulated, starting from this paper in 90s, with so-called thin and envelope approximations. This is animation. So let me repeat. Yeah, I hope you see my point. Thin means that energy localization is thin. And the released energy, the assumption is energy momentum tensor is localized along this line, and its value grows like the total value of the released energy, if it is cubic in radius, divided by the surface area. So Tij grows linearly in radius. And the other approximation is envelope approximation. It means that the surface disappears as soon as it collides. So we keep track of only this envelope. And traditionally,
this last assumption, yeah, how correct it is? Well, definitely at the point where the shells annihilate, there is an energy injection, which is very strong, yeah?
This approximation.
When the two shells collide.
This approximation is incorrect. So that's why we modified the system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So this is, this is traditional modeling, which we start from. I will modify this. Yeah, this kind of system was simulated. People explicitly create bubble nucleation points, simulate bubble nucleation points, and trace the surface of the bubble to call the Gaussian wave spectrum. But what we did is that Gaussian wave spectrum from this system is completely analytically calculable. That's what we pointed out in 2016 paper. So let me briefly, very briefly explain this. We start from equation of motion for Gaussian waves. And when we have this kind of wave equation, we can formally write down the solution, like convolution of the Green function times the source term in the right-hand side. Here, P is projection to the transverse transverse component. And if we recollect that the Gaussian wave power spectrum is essentially two-point correlator of this Hij, then we can substitute Hij, this Hij, into this Gaussian wave spectrum. As a result, what we get is two convolution time integration with T1, T2, which comes from this, times two Green functions rearranged to cosine. And the only non-trivial part is the two-point ensemble average of the energy momentum tensor. Here, ensemble average arises because we consider infinitely big system, that is the whole universe. And what we pointed out is that two-point correlator can be calculated analytically from considerations on light cones. So let me sketch the essence. The calculation of the two-point correlator, Tij, Tkl. And actually, this is a junior high school calculation. So let me explain three steps. Since this is a product of two quantities, which has arguments, x and y, we have to fix x and y first. Let's fix x and y. And if in 4D perspective, it means that we fix this point x and this point y. And calculating ensemble average means that to list all possible configurations for the shells, and for each configuration, we calculate the product Tij, Tkl, and the probability for that configuration to happen. This is junior high school calculation about expectation value. And then after listing everything, we can sum up this Tij, Tkl times the probability for it to happen. And in 3D perspective, we fix point X and point Y like this. And listing all possible shell configuration means that we, in region one, we have this kind of bubble or this kind of already collided bubbles, blah, blah, blah. And in region two, we have this kind of stuff. And of course, some possible correlation may arise between one and two, but actually this can be classified in a very simple way using this kind of light cone argument. Now, let me show you the analytical result. What we showed is that rational wave spectrum can be strictly decomposed into two contributions. And this is not truncation, but this is exact strict result. And the first contribution is convolution of exponential times spherical Bessel function times some polynomial. It's really junior high school math, computed with cosine. And we get this kind of rational wave spectrum. And now, we had a question previously. In realistic systems, the shells do not vanish just after they collide, but what we know is rather they propagate inside the other bubbles. So we need to modify this kind of, that all the type of modeling. And that's what we did in this 2017 paper. Our assumption is, again, the shells are still thin and it grows like radius to the first power before collision. But after collision, there's no more energy release. So Tij localized in this region decreases like radius to the power of minus two. And important point is that this system is no longer envelope. We consider the collided shells into account. And actually, rational wave spectrum can be calculated in a similar way as before. And I will, of course, I'll omit details because this is a short talk. And analytical result is like this. Again, the rational wave spectrum can be strictly decomposed into two contributions. And the first term is six-dimensional integration. And the second term is 10-dimensional integration of some exponential and spherical Bessel and polynomials. That's it. So this strict spectrum, exact spectrum behaves like this. So let's focus on this red line first. This is wave number versus Gaussian wave spectrum. And previously in old modeling, thin and envelope modeling, we had spectrum like this, k to cubic, wave number cubic, and wave number inverse. But once we take collided shells into account, we observe enhancement of the Gaussian wave spectrum in IR region, like this. That's what we pointed out in this paper. And there's clear physical explanation for this, but there's clear physical explanation for this. So let me explain that. The physical explanation is that, okay, let's take typical collision time to be T0, and let's call a typical bubble size L0. Around this time, the Gaussian wave spectrum is peaked around L0 inverse, but later, the typical bubble size or typical shell size expand like L1, L2, as shown in this bottom figure. And when the typical bubble size is L1, the Gaussian wave spectrum at L1 is sourced. And when the typical size is L2, wave number at L2 inverse is sourced. So this is very clear physically. And yeah, so as a result, we pointed out, the enhanced prospect, enhanced possibility of detection for this kind of transition. So now let me summarize, sorry for running out of time. So summary, Gaussian waves provide us with the opportunity to test first order transitions in the early universe in the coming decades. But in extremely strong transitions, it's typically hard to predict the Gaussian wave signal, even though they're at least observationally interesting. And in what we showed that in such transition, the fluid shells may remain to be thin after the transition. I put may because this is not conclusive yet. And the Gaussian wave enhancement from broken sound shells, overlapping broken sound shells may not occur. However, we pointed out that IR enhancement of the Gaussian wave signal is expected from long-lived expanding shells, which enhances observational prospects. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, are there any more questions for the speaker?
Yeah, I think I still have a question. So, yeah, about this bubble collision and the kind of propagation of the shell after the collision. So you just scale down the initial energy density of the shell as it expands, as I understand. But don't you need to take into account additional energy release due to annihilation of the scalar field at the bubble collision?
Yeah, that's a very good point, which I forgot to explain. Maybe in this slide. So I explained that in this one transition 1, 2, 3, the wall reaches terminal velocity. And in this type of transition, this may sound a bit non-trivial, but the energy density from scalar field is actually negligible because let me explain using animation. In this animation, maybe you see that the shell thickness linearly increases as bubble expands. It's kind of self-similar profile. But as a result, the energy stored, the energy accumulated in the shell increases cubic in radius because the thickness increases and also, of course, the surface increases. Surface area increases. Mm-hmm. But in contrast, the scalar field, the energy density, the energy accumulated in the scalar field grows only quadratically in radius because the wall reaches to terminal velocity, so the thickness is constant. So the energy density accumulated on the wall is just from surface area. Mm-hmm. So as a result, after the bubble the bubble expands to cosmological size, the energy density from scalar field is super negligible, even in this kind of strong transitions. Mm-hmm. So the typical suppression is like cosmological scale over particle scale. It's like Hubble size.
Well, it depends on gamma of the wall. Yeah, so. Yeah, in that case, gamma is large. Yeah, the boost factor is large. So, but
yeah, gamma is large, but the hierarchy between cosmological scale and particle is bigger. So, yeah, typically still in this dimension.
I see. Yeah, and then I have a general question. So, yeah, about the prospects of testing, you know, these cosmological backgrounds. Because we also have a lot of astrophysical stochastic background. So how will we discriminate between astrophysics and this
primordial? Yeah, that's again a very good question. Okay, so what I can say is in this plot, what I plotted is omega GW, and this is Russian wave energy density stored as stochastic Gaussian waves. But on the other hand, this blue region is expected signal from astrophysical sources. But these astrophysical sources, at least some of these astrophysical sources have point-like, I mean, directions, specific directions where they come from. So what people expect is that they identify each source as precisely as possible and subtract that contribution from stochastic background. So in that sense, this kind of astrophysical background, or I should say foreground maybe, can be reduced by some amount. That's what people expect. And this is very, how can I say, this explanation is not quantitative. Actually, I'm one of the members of LISA cosmology working group, and I know that some people are seriously working on this kind of subtraction of this point-like source. That's what I can say for now.
Yeah, on top of point-like source, there will be plenty of unresolved sources. That's also expected.
And yeah, unresolved
probably now.
Yeah, that's a good question. We have to develop some clever smart way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In the extreme case, really extreme case, the Gaussian wave signal actually dominates the astrophysical unresolved background. For example, this unresolved galactic binary. So if we are really lucky, we can see this signal instead of this kind of unresolved background. But if the transient is weaker, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just make sure I understand correctly? So it's only in the strong detonation case that there's this IR enhancement from K to the 3 to K to the 1, is that right?
Or no? That's another too good question. Okay, so typically in this kind of transition in one and region 1 and 2, people just focus on Gaussian wave production at the typical shell thickness scale. Because numerical simulation focuses on Gaussian wave production at this scale. But as you can clearly see, for example, from this animation, there's clearly bubble-like structure, even in this kind of weak transition. So we expect some signal from this kind of expanding bubble-like structure even after transition. But numerically, it's a bit difficult because expanding bubbles, we have to have many expanded bubbles inside our simulation box. So it's numerically difficult. So there's still controversy about it.
I see. Oh, okay. So conceivably, there could be a significant IR enhancement beyond what's currently reported, even for that case.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are no more questions, we can thank Ryusuke again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We can stop the recording.
Thanks very much.